Angry Orchard, Colorado. Written by J.C. Halsey. Narrated by Chaz Allen. Chapter 1. Orville Halfloaf and myself were getting ready to leave Velvet Sky, Arizona territories. We were at my uncle's ranch when I received a telegram from the mayor of Angry Orchard, Colorado territories. It said, "You are needed in Angry Orchard, Colorado territories. There's a group of 4 men terrorizing our town. We've heard about you from my brother in Windy Butte, New Mexico. He said that you had helped them with a similar problem. We are willing to compensate you for your time if you could see your way clear to help us. Please, if you can, come at once. Cordially yours, C.D. Watkins, Mayor." Well, we had talked it over and decided that I should go ahead by stagecoach. I could get there a lot faster than if I traveled with them. I do wish I could spend more time with my uncle. I'd just met him, and I was enjoying visiting with him and his family. However, this telegram changed all that. I was needed elsewhere because someone was in trouble. We decided that Orville and Halfloaf would come later with the buckboard and to bring Sugar, my Appaloosa. I could travel there in a week's time if I went by stagecoach. Traveling 20 miles a day in the buckboard would take a month to get there. If the town needed help against these hooligans, then I needed to get there as soon as possible. We left my uncle's ranch and went into Velvet Sky. I would catch the stagecoach there, so I gathered what little belongings I had, rolled up my holster and gun, packed them in my haversack, and waited for the stage to arrive. Stage line clerk said it should arrive about a half an hour. I asked the clerk some things about the stage, and he explained that about every 50 miles it would stop at a relay station or home station to change out the horses and get something to eat. You would have as long as it took to change the horses to eat your meal. He pointed to a poster on the wall and said, "Well, maybe you'd better read that poster." The poster read, "You will be traveling through Indian country, and the safety of your persons cannot be vouchified by anyone but God." Interesting, I said. Chapter 2. I suggested that we go to Big Gertie's Cafe and get some of the iced tea that we had before. We walked up the street to Gertie's place and sat at the same tables as before. Halfloaf was excited about getting to see Polly again. He had met with her after she got off work the last time we were here. This time, a different young lady came to our table and asked, "What'll it be, gentlemen?" But before I could say anything, Halfloaf asked, "Where is Polly?" "She isn't here anymore. She left to go to New York to sing in the opera." "Oh, I am happy for her," exclaimed Halfloaf. "However, I do wish I could have told her goodbye." "We gonna order or not?" asked Orville. "The stage will be here any minute now." "We'll have 3 glasses of iced tea," I said. She returned with 3 tall glasses filled to the brim with tea and chopped ice. "Really hits the spot," said Orville. "Never ridden in a stagecoach before," I said. Orville said, "Nothing to it. It's just like riding in a wagon, except you're riding inside a box." "It has been almost a half an hour," said Halfloaf. "Reckon we better get back to the stage office," I said. And we walked back to the stage office, stepped up onto the boardwalk, sat down on the bench in front of the office. Halfloaf said, "I wish I was coming with you, Jed." "Orville's going to need your help on the trip," I told him. There was a loud noise coming from the edge of town. We stood up and saw the stage rushing around the corner of Main Street. "Well, won't be long now." Halfloaf asked, "Is he going to stop?" Just then the driver pulled back hard on the reins and hollered, "Whoa!" He was a big barrel-chested guy wearing a steel-gray shirt, brown trousers, and large, sweat-stained hat. He sported a raven black handlebar mustache, and when he looked at you, it was like he was looking all the way through you. The voice was very rough and loud.
"Everybody out that's getting out. We'll be pulling out in 10 minutes.
"Well, I'll see you 2 rascals in a month or so," I said. We embraced as if we would never see each other again.
"All aboard, all those who's getting aboard," shouted the driver.
Chapter 3. I climbed inside the coach and placed my haversack on my knees. There was room for 6 passengers with 1 bench seat facing forward and 1 facing the rear. The seats were so crowded our knees kept bumping into one another. There were 4 other passengers inside, 3 men and a woman. The men wore suits, and one had what looked to be a doctor's satchel.
One of the others looked like a cattle buyer, and the third one looked like a cowboy. The woman was an elderly lady wearing a yellow and blue dress. Her hands firmly clutched a pink reticule, and she had wavy steel gray hair. She was wearing a bright yellow hat with a feather on top, and every time the coach hit a bump, that feather did a little dance. The cowboy was asleep, and he kept bumping the lady every time the coach hit a bump. The second man was chunky, had a square face and short, curly hair. He was dressed in a tan jacket, brown pants, and black boots. He had a bottle in his hand, and he was putting it to his lips constantly. I could smell the liquor from where I was sitting. I could never understand why men wanted to drink that foul-smelling stuff. Back in Angel Falls, I would see men as they staggered out of the saloon. Some would fall down before they even got into the street. Thank God I don't have a desire for that stuff. The man sitting beside me with the satchel said, "My name's Lincoln J. Ferguson, a doctor." He was young, probably in his early 30s, wearing wire-rimmed glasses. He was dressed in a double-breasted blue suit. A swath of dark brown hair with a reddish tint kept falling over his forehead, and he kept brushing it back. As we hit a big bump, the cowboy, who was asleep, bumped into the lady again. The lady asked, "May I sit with you, young man?" "Of course, ma'am. I'd be honored," I answered. She slid next to me. "Some people have no manners at all," she said. "Yes, ma'am," I answered. "Could have sat with me, ma'am," the doctor said. "You know very well, young man, there wasn't any room until those men got off at the last stop," she huffed. "Yes, ma'am, I'm sorry I offended you in any way," said the doctor. "Where might you be traveling to?" I asked the doc. "Going to a little town called Clearstone, Wyoming. I'm replacing the doctor who's been there for 25 years. He's finally retiring." "Sounds as though you have some big shoes to fill," I said, "what with him having been there 25 years. "Yes, it'll be quite a challenge," he replied. "And you, ma'am, may I ask where you're heading?"
"My name is Mildred Lathrop, and I'm going to live with my youngest daughter in Mulberry Springs, Idaho. She's ill and needs my help with my 6 grandchildren and the housekeeping," she said.
"Like I said to the doc, it sounds like you have big shoes to fill."
And as the doctor answered, "It is a challenge. However, I'm a retired schoolteacher. I started teaching after my husband passed away. After teaching 24 children in a 1-room schoolhouse, I do believe I will be up to the task."
The man across from us, the one awake, the one with the bottle, said, "My name's Tracy Kaplan. I'm on my way to Wyoming to buy cattle. I own the Rock Creek Ranch just outside of Juniper, Texas. This gentleman here is my foreman. His name's Russell Easley." I could see snow-white hair sticking out from beneath the foreman's hat. His bushy beard was also white, and he was wearing dungarees and a white shirt with a string tie and leather vest. He looked like a real cowboy, unlike his boss, who had a clean-shaven face with hands so smooth it looked like he hadn't worked a day in his life. I found out later that he was from Illinois. He had bought that ranch 2 years ago because he'd always wanted to own one. I looked into everyone's face and said, "My name's Jedediah Jenkins. I'm on my way to Angry Orchard, Colorado, to confront some bad men."
"What do you mean, confront?" asked Mildred.
"Well, ma'am, sometimes you have to do things that you don't want to do," I answered. "You mean kill, don't you?" asked the doctor.
"Yes, doctor, if necessary," I said. "I will kill them." "But you look so young and innocent. You don't look like a killer," exclaimed Mrs. Lathrop.
"Ma'am, I'll do everything I can to keep from killing anyone. But these men must be stopped. They're terrorizing a whole town," I explained.
Mrs. Lathrop said, "I can't believe you would kill another human being."
"Do what's got to be done, ma'am," I answered. "There are a lot of evil men in this country. Someone has to stop them from hurting other people. And I feel that it's my job."
Chapter 4. Riding in a stagecoach was kind of like sitting in a rocking chair, except when it would hit a bump. As we rocked along, the softest whisper of wind blew through the window and across my body, and raindrops blew onto my shoulder and arm. The cooler air was a relief to us all. If it started to rain really hard, we would have to close the curtains. However, that hadn't happened this time. The foreman began to stir and wake up. He stretched as much as he could, then pushed his hat off his eyes. He looked to be in his mid-40s, although his craggy face and leathery skin made him look older. He had a crooked nose that looked like it had been hit a few times, and a bushy, snow-white beard. He said, "Howdy, folks. How's everybody?
Rain sure smells cool, don't it? We ought to be getting close to the relay station. He turned in his seat, tried looking out the window. Can't see a blasted thing. How about you, young fella? Can you see anything out your window?
I tried looking out my window and couldn't make out anything. Can't see too far ahead, I told him.
We heard the driver shout, 4 to 5 minutes to relay station.
The rain had stopped, and it sure didn't take long to start heating up. The doctor was wiping his forehead with a polka-dot handkerchief, and Mrs. Lathrop was wiping her face with a dainty white handkerchief. The rest of us, apparently, were more used to heat, as none of us were wiping anything. The stagecoach pulled up in front of the relay station, then the driver jumped down and opened the door.
30 minute stop to change out the team, rest and eat. Eats are $1 served inside the station. Women's outhouse to the right, men's to the left. Can't wait to turn. There's a lot of bushes. Watch out for the snakes.
I carried my haversack with me because I had my 45 in it. Like Orville said one time, can't never tell when you might need it.
Chapter 5. The men from the station started unhitching the team. When they were done, they led them towards the corral. Two more men were bringing up a fresh team of Mustangs and started hooking them to the stagecoach. They worked together very well and were finished in record time. The horses were hooked up, and the stagecoach was ready to go before all of us were finished. Inside of the station was one big room that had two long tables with attached benches. We all sat down as the cook brought plates piled high with roast beef, gravy, mashed potatoes, and green beans. The beef was so tender you could cut it with a fork. Mr. Kaplan's foreman said, "Man, I ain't had this good a chow since old Cookie passed on. He was a cook at the ranch for 20 years or more." That was afore Mr. Kaplan bought the ranch. Mr. Kaplan said, "Now, Easley, you know the cook we have is very good." The foreman retorted, "Can't fuss with you about that, boss, but he ain't as good as old Cookie was." We finished eating, got back onto the stagecoach, and settled in as best we could. As soon as we were settled, the stagecoach jerked, and it took off, throwing Mr. Kaplan and Easley across the aisle and into us. We all got straightened out and settled back into our seats. "Oh, that was exciting," exclaimed Easley.
Chapter 6. We rode for probably 2 hours when the driver informed us that we were near a lay of sand 4 miles in length, and we were going to have to walk through it if we expected to arrive at our next stop on time. Shortly after we started our trek, the moon was shaded with a cool mist, which soaked us through and through. It lasted the complete 4 miles as we plodded through the deep, heavy sand. Soon as we were clear of the sand, the mist mysteriously stopped. We got back on the coach, wet and tired. "There should be another way to go without walking through sand," Kaplan exclaimed.
"Little walking never hurt nobody," said Easley.
With the coach rocking back and forth, I began to feel drowsy. I twisted and turned and closed my eyes and fell asleep. The next thing I knew, I was feeling the coach stop.
20 minute stop, change out the team and eat breakfast. Meals cost 50 cents. Outhouses just like the last time, ready to roll in 20 minutes.
Breakfast consisted of beef jerky, raw onions, crackers, slightly wormy, and a bit of bacon.
"Not as good as old Cookie," said Easley.
Mrs. Lathrop said, "I sure hope the next meal is better."
"I'm sure it will be," said the doctor. "All aboard," shouted the driver as he climbed back up on the stagecoach.
We all hurried out the door and clambered into the coach. Just like the last time, we had just gotten seated and the coach jerked as it took off. However, this time we were expecting it, so everyone stayed in their seat.
Chapter 7. As we traveled towards our destination, I looked out my window at the clouds. They seemed to change in appearance as the sun peaked above the jagged, snow-covered mountaintops. They were a gorgeous sight. We rode for possibly an hour when the driver hollered, "Whoa!" while pulling back on the horse's reins. We all stepped out of the coach.
"What's the matter?" asked Dr. Ferguson.
"Something or somebody on the road up there."
He pointed towards the front.
"Let's go take a look," I suggested.
"I'll wait here," Kaplan said, "with the doc and Mrs. Lathrop." "Perhaps I should go. After all, I am a doctor." The doctor, the driver, Easley, and me walked up the road to where a body was lying. It was a man, and he'd been shot. Dr. Ferguson kneeled down to check for any sign of life, and he said he had a very weak pulse. The doctor started to get up, but the man grabbed his arm, and then his eyes flickered open and his parched lips quivered.
"Thirsty," he whispered. "Need water."
"Don't talk. Save your strength. I'll get you some water," I said. The driver said,
"I'll get it. It's in the boot."
He returned with a canteen, and I helped the injured man raise up enough to take a sip of water.
Good, he murmured. "Outlaw shot me. Took my horse. The bad ones. You need to be careful. Be on the lookout for them." He tried to sit up. "Promise me. Tell my wife I love her. Got papers in pocket."
And those were his last words. He slumped forward, drawing his last breath. We stretched him out on the ground, and I whispered a prayer for his soul.
"We ain't got time to bury him," said the driver. "Not if we want to keep to our schedule."
"Well, I think we can spare a little time to lay this man to rest," said Dr. Ferguson.
"Okay, but don't blame me when you're late for our next stop."
Easley said, "Maybe if we skip a meal like the breakfast we had, that'd make up for it." We dug a grave over by a small sycamore tree, wrapped the body in a blanket, then lowered it into the shallow grave. We took turns, filling in dirt. "Let's pray," I said. "Dear Lord, we didn't know this man, but you did. You knew his way of living, even his very thoughts. Please accept his soul into your bosom, the way you would an innocent child. Amen." Chapter 8. Everyone got back on the stage, and the driver hollered, "Giddy up!" And we were on our way again. Kaplan asked, "Think we'll have trouble with them outlaws?"
"You don't need to worry, boss. I'll protect you."
"You don't even have a gun. How are you going to protect me?" "You just think I don't have a gun." And he reached into his satchel and took out a Colt 45 similar to mine. "Don't go no place without my pistola." "I also have my pistol," I said. "Then I suppose we'll at least have a fighting chance," said Kaplan.
"Maybe we won't have to resort to violence," said Mrs. Lathrop.
"I don't think we'll have any trouble with outlaws," I said. "If you notice, there's only the driver. There were two men, a driver and a shotgun rider. Then we might have trouble. When there's a shotgun rider, that means they're carrying something important, like payroll or gold, something like that."
"They don't consider the passengers important?" asked Kaplan.
"Not as important as gold," answered Easley.
After hearing that, everyone seemed to settle down and enjoy the ride. Well, as much as one can enjoy the ride in a stagecoach. The ride became monotonous, with the miles, the rocking motion, the flat, wide-open land, and the dust. Oh, my, the dust. No one was saying anything. Everyone seemed to be lost in their own thoughts, more than likely thinking about the dead man and contemplating their own existence in God's creation. Easley was asleep again, this time with more room to relax and stretched out. He snored almost as loud as Orville.
"I wish he would stop that," Mrs. Lathrop exclaimed.
"It isn't his fault," explained Dr. Ferguson. "Some people have a narrow nasal passage that doesn't let enough air pass through. It may also be caused from the position a person is lying." He reached across the aisle and pushed Easley into a different position. Then the snoring stopped.
"Oh, thank you so much, doctor," said Mrs. Lathrop.
Chapter 9. I was enjoying the mountains and the forests of ponderosa pines, as well as the large groups of cattle grazing in the flatlands.
"Whoa, hold up there, whoa!"
The coach came to a stop.
"What now?" Kaplan quipped. "Everybody out, there's something in the road."
We all stepped out of the coach and looked up ahead. A big bunch of broken roots from the remains of a dead cottonwood tree had broken free from the hard-packed earth alongside the road. There wasn't enough room to maneuver around it, so we're going to have to move it to the side of the road. All the men tried pulling it to the side, but it was too heavy.
"Seeing as how we ain't got no tools nor axe to chop it up small, there's just one way to get it moved," the driver said. "I'll have to use the horses."
I helped the driver unhitch the first two horses. We moved them into place alongside the dead roots and tied a long rope around them. The driver took the reins in his hands, then slapped them against the horses' flanks. The pile of rubble started moving. He kept the horses headed towards the side of the road, where it was flat enough to drag the roots.
That should do it. Let's hook him back up and get on down the road, said the driver.
I helped him hitch the two horses back to the team.
Thank you, young feller, said the driver.
My name's Jed, I told him. He wiped his forehead with a purple bandana.
Okay, Jed. Everybody load up and let's go.
Perhaps an hour later, the driver shouted,
Buford Mills, 10 minutes.
We rolled up to the station, and the station master was waiting outside on the boardwalk.
An hour and 45 minutes late, Johnson. You've got a new passenger when you leave. Couldn't be helped. 30-minute stop. Meals inside. Outhouse in the back. Ladies go first. Please.
Inside of the station was pretty much the same as all the others, containing two long tables with attached benches. The meals consisted of antelope stew, bread, and coffee. It costs $1. I ate the stew, and I remembered back to Tom's trading post where Orville, Halfloaf, and me ate antelope stew for a week or more. This stew wasn't half as good as that.
Chapter 10.
When we finished, we climbed back into the coach. There was a gentleman sitting facing the front. He was wearing an ill-fitted, rumpled gray suit over a pale blue shirt. He had a thin face, pointed chin, sharp gunmetal gray eyes, and long blonde hair reaching below his collar. As Mrs. Lathrop got inside, she said, "You're sitting in our seat, young man."
"My apologies, ma'am."
And he quickly moved across the aisle to sit between Kaplan and Easley.
"My name's Joshua Prescott, going to Prescott, Nebraska."
Funny, isn't it? Prescott, going to Prescott.
"I have the privilege of being the only minister of the church in Prescott."
We introduced ourselves to the minister and settled in for the ride to the next stop. Approximately 2 hours later, we heard shots, four of them, and we saw four men riding horses alongside the coach. I removed my gun from my haversack and tucked it inside my shirt. Easley did the same.
"Hold up, driver," one of them yelled, and the coach came to a stop. "Get down, driver. Everybody inside, get on out here."
One by one, we exited the coach.
"Hands in the air, no funny stuff."
All but one of the men dismounted. He was holding his gun on us, watching closely.
"You carrying gold or money?" asked the leader. "Nope, no money, no gold," said the driver. "How about you, gentlemen? Anything important? And let's not leave the lady out. Anything, ma'am?"
"Perhaps we can talk this over and reach a conclusion that will satisfy everyone," said Kaplan. "I own one of the largest cattle ranches in Texas. When we get to the next town, I can wire for any amount of money you want.
How would that be?" "You're a cattle buyer. Where's all your buying money?"
"I never carry large amounts of cash on me. Too dangerous."
"Ain't that the truth?" the bandit laughed. "Tell that to the man back down the road."
And while they were discussing what they were going to do, Easley and me had worked our hands into our shirts and quickly pulled out our pistols.
"Hold it right there," I ordered.
The man on the horse turned his gun towards me as Easley shot him out of the saddle.
"Everybody duck," I shouted.
My first shot was at the leader. His gun was cocked and ready to fire when my bullet knocked him on his back, his blank eyes staring upward. Easley ducked behind the coach's back wheel and threw a shot towards the last man, then hollered,
"Hands up and I won't shoot."
The man put his hands in the air. "Please don't shoot. I don't want to die." He looked to be about my age. How he got mixed up with these bad ones, only he knew. "Carefully take your gun out of the holster and toss it butt first to me," I told him. He took his gun out and tossed it to me.
"Oh, my," Mrs. Lathrop exclaimed. "I think I understand now why you were telling me about having to do what is necessary to survive."
"Yep, we hadn't killed them. They sure enough had killed us," Easley proclaimed. Easley and me replaced the spent cartridges that we had fired and returned our guns to our bags. The driver said,
"Suppose you want to bury the varmints."
"You would be correct in assuming that," Reverend Prescott said. We dug one large, shallow grave for the dead outlaws and placed their bodies in and started shoveling dirt over them. "Reverend, would you pray over these lost souls and ask God to grant them entrance into his holy kingdom?" I asked.
"Yes, I'd be glad to. Thank you for asking."
We all bowed our heads, listening as the Reverend prayed, each one of us thinking about the dead outlaws and how it could be one of us in that grave, if not for God's grace and guidance in our lives.
Chapter 11.
When the Reverend had finished, the driver said,
"Well, come on. We're already late as it is. Jed, will you tie those horses to the back of the coach? This young fellow will have to ride up beside me. Not enough room inside with you folks.
We have to tie your hands? Easily said to the young man.
Will you be good?
I'll be good. What are you going to do with me?
We'll hand you over to the sheriff in the next town, Driver said. But I'm telling you, don't look good. What with the fella that we buried back down the road a ways?
I didn't do that. It was Rance. He shot that fella and took his horse. He didn't have no reason to shoot him. That man's saddlebags didn't have nothing in them other than clothes.
Rance is just plain mean.
Charlie and Jack weren't so bad, but they did what Rance told them without fussing too much.
Maybe if you explain that to the sheriff, he'll go easy on you, Mrs. Lathrop told him.
Maybe, the young man said quietly.
With everyone on board, we were once again in traveling mode. The coach rocked, swayed, and bumped as we traveled onward to our destination. The setting sun was shining inside the coach, illuminating our faces with an orange glow. Easley's beard took on a bright, shiny white color with a tinge of yellow. The air had cooled, and there was a breeze blowing through the windows.
Chapter 12
Grape Harbor, 30 minutes, called the driver.
It was well past 8 o'clock when the stage stopped in front of the station.
Same story as before, said the driver. We'll leave a little later, because I have to turn this young outlaw over to the sheriff. Probably be an hour. Eats inside, cost a dollar.
The meal was enjoyable enough, but we had better in our travels. After the meal, we still had time to look around. The reverend and the doctor said they were going to take a stroll through town, maybe see if there was a doctor and check out the church. Mrs. Lathrop was going to sit on the bench in front of the station and rest. Kaplan said he was going to the saloon. That left Easley and myself.
Think I'll tag along with the boss, try to keep him from getting into too much trouble, said Easley.
I'm just going to walk around a bit. Better keep an eye on the time.
I walked south from the stagecoach office, looking at all the sights. Grape Harbor was bigger than all the other towns we'd passed through, even bigger than Angel Falls, which I always considered pretty big. This town was loud and bright. Gas street lamps lit the main thoroughfares. I counted 4 saloons along this street, and they were all going at full speed. Loud piano music, laughter, voices, and various sounds were coming through the doors. As I passed in front of the first saloon, a man came barreling through the door, landed on his back directly in front of me. From past experience in Angel Falls, I knew the best thing for me to do would be to walk around him and continue on my way. However, I don't always do what's best. I reached down and tried to help the man to his feet. He was heavier than he looked, and he stumbled, pulling me to the ground on top of him.
Hey, watch what you're trying to do.
Just being nice, I said, trying to get you out of the middle of the street.
Just leave me be. I can get up by myself.
All right, have it your way, I said, and I picked myself up and continued walking down the street. I took my pocket watch, the one I got from my grandfather, from my shirt pocket, looked at the time, and decided it was time to head back to the stage depot.
Chapter 13 Everyone was aboard when I arrived.
Hurry up, Jed. Wouldn't want to leave anybody behind, driver said.
I climbed in and sat next to a window where I'd been sitting the whole trip. I figured it was around 200 miles to Angry Orchard. I settled into my seat, pulled my hat down, closed my eyes, and slowly drifted off. The bright sun was shining through my window and right into my face. I tried pulling my hat lower, but it didn't help. I reckoned I was going to have to wake up. I sure hoped our next stop was close, because I was feeling the need to go, and I knew the driver wasn't going to stop for me to relieve myself. Not that I was going to ask him. I squeezed my legs tight and tried not to think about it. Then I looked out the window and saw a large herd of cattle. And what were the majority of the cows doing? That's right, relieving themselves.
Next stop, straight ahead, 5 minutes, driver hollered.
Thank goodness, I thought to myself. Couldn't have waited much longer. The stage stopped just shy of the station.
Sorry I can't get any closer, folks. This'll have to do.
Excuse me, I said, and I jumped through the door like there was a fire, bumping into the reverend as I exited. Sorry, excuse me, please. Ran as fast as I could towards the bushes on the other side of the road. Boy, did I feel relieved. Walked back to the station house, and everyone was already seated, eating their meals. So I sat down on the very end, away from the others.
Make it, kid?
Easley asked, laughing at me.
Yes, thank you for asking, I said.
"Where'd you rush off to?" said Kaplan.
"Well, if you'd stop and think about it, you wouldn't have to ask," said the doctor.
"We all have to go every once in a while. Sometimes we just don't know when or where."
"Thank you, doctor, for your understanding," I said.
"Time's up. Let's roll," said the driver.
Chapter 14. More monotonous rocking motion caused me to doze off and on for the next few hours.
"Angry Orchard, 45 minutes away," shouted the driver.
Even after all the delays that we encountered, we arrived in Angry Orchard just 3 days late. It had taken 8 days to travel from Angel Falls, Texas, to Angry Orchard, Colorado. Climbed down from the coach and said goodbye to all my traveling companions.
"If you're ever in Clearstone, Wyoming territory, please look me up," said the doctor, extending his hand.
I shook the offered hand and replied, "I'll be sure to do just that," I said. Mrs. Lathrop said, "I don't know if you'll want to visit an old woman, but if you do, I'll be in Mulberry Springs, Idaho, and Jed, please take care of yourself." And she gave me a big hug.
"I would count it an honor to visit such a beautiful young lady as yourself," I told her.
The Reverend took my hand in his. "I know you hear this all the time, but this time it's said with a sincere heart," he said. "If you need anything at all, please let me know. You'll be in my prayers. Please take care and remember, God guides us on all our journeys." Kaplan had his bag and was walking towards the saloon.
"Some folks got no manners at all.
Think you know who I mean," exclaimed Easley.
"Jed, boy, if you ever need anything at all, you just holler. I'll come a-running. You've been one I've been proud to cross a river with."
His hand was rough and calloused, like a working man's hand.
"Been a real pleasure knowing you, Russell."
Chapter 15. I picked up my bag, strapped on my gun and holster, and walked towards the middle of town. I spotted the sheriff's office, then I remembered the mayor stating in his telegram that the sheriff had been killed. There was a barber shop next to the sheriff's office, and I walked inside. The barber said, "Have a seat, young man. I'll be with you as soon as I finish with Frank's hair."
"Well, thanks," I said, "but I'm looking for the mayor."
"Say, you're not that young fella he's been expecting, are you?"
"Well, might be," I said. "Could you tell me where I could find him?"
"Sure thing. This time of day, be at Shirley's Restaurant. He always goes there to conduct meetings. Go down the street, turn to the right on First Street. Right there, can't miss it," the barber said.
I walked to First Street, spotted the restaurant, then stepped inside. Inside, I saw two gentlemen seated at different tables. One was dressed in dungarees, the other in a rumpled brown suit. I dismissed the one in dungarees and walked up to the one in the suit. He was completely bald, had a round, flushed face with thick, bushy eyebrows.
Chapter 16.
"Lou, sir, my name's Jed Jenkins, and I believe we have some business to discuss."
"Oh, my, am I glad to see you," he exclaimed.
"We're desperately in need of your help. Please sit down. I'll explain it to you. When I sent the telegram to you, there were four men. Since then, two of them have left town. However, the two that stayed are the meanest of the group. They have no morals whatsoever, no respect for people in town. They killed the sheriff first day they were here, taken over the saloon, the hotel, the general store, and they ordered people to do reprehensible things. They must be stopped," said the mayor.
"Why haven't the citizens done anything about these men?"
"Oh, we aren't gunmen. Most of us don't even own a gun. That's why we sent for you. My brother said you could help us. Could you please rid us of this terrible pestilence?"
"Let me get a room in the hotel," I said, "get a night's rest under my belt, and we'll look at this problem in the morning."
"I've a room for you at my house. As I told you, these men have taken over the hotel. Please come with me. I'll take you there."
We walked to the edge of town to a two-story house with a white fence in front.
"This is it. Please come inside," Mayor said. "My wife and daughter will be glad to meet you. We've waited for what seemed like a long time, though it's only been a little more than 2 weeks. Please come on in."
We walked in the entrance hall.
"We're here," Mayor Watkins said loudly.
Two very lovely ladies came around the corner of a door. They looked to be sisters until I could see them closer. One was a younger version of the older one. The older one had brown hair pulled back into a French twist, while the younger had strawberry blonde hair hanging down to her collar with a sprinkling of freckles across her nose. She wasn't exceptionally pretty, but she would do. They were both tiny, probably 5 feet even.
They were both wearing matching yellow butterfly dresses. The younger one had turquoise eyes, while her mother's were hazel.
"This is my wife," said the mayor, "Mrs. Loretta Watkins, and my daughter, Lacey Jean."
"Pleased to make your acquaintance," I said. "I do hope I'm not putting you out by staying here."
"Nonsense. We're glad to have you as a guest. Supper will be ready in half an hour. If you would like to freshen up, Lacey will show you to your room," said the mother.
"At your service, ma'am. Lead the way," I said. I thought to myself, oh, what a pretty sight, following behind this young woman. I must stop thinking like that.
"This is your room," said Lacey. "There's fresh water in the pitcher, there on the table. I'll call you when it's time to eat." And she turned to leave.
"Well, thank you for your hospitality," I said. And I watched her walk away. I went into the room, threw my bag on the bed, removed my hat, my holster, and my jacket. I poured water into the bowl and bent down and splashed my face. It was quite refreshing. I dried with the towel, laid down on the bed, and asked the Lord if this was what he wanted me to do. I felt an inner voice whisper to me. It said, "These people need rescuing." And then I dozed off. I heard a knock on the door. "Supper's ready." "Be right there." And I got off the bed, splashed more water on my face, and went downstairs.
Chapter 17. "Come in here, Jed. Sit here at the head of the table, since you're our guest. Mrs. Watkins is making her great-grandmother's Norwegian goulash," said the mayor. "The recipe has been passed down through generations, and it's the best goulash in the whole country. Mrs. Watkins makes it each year for the 4th of July parade and picnic." She set a big bowl down in the middle of the table along with bread, butter, and apple cider. It was indeed very tasty. When we were finished eating, Mrs. Watkins suggested that Lacey and I go for a walk in the garden.
"You'll probably need your wrap, Lacey," she said.
"Shall we go?" said Lacey as she slipped her arm through mine.
"Isn't the moon so bright and pretty tonight?" she said. "Do you have a girlfriend, Jed?"
"No, I don't have a girlfriend," I said.
"I think you and I would make a nice couple, don't you think, Jed? Let's sit on the bench over here."
We sat down and she scooted as close to me as she could. I said, "Well, there are certain circumstances in my life that don't give me the opportunity to have a girlfriend. Didn't your father tell you why I'm here in Angry Orchard?"
"Why, of course, you're here to help him get those bad men to leave town," Lacey said.
"And what if they don't leave? Did he tell you what happens then?"
"No, he just said you were here to help him."
"Well, if they don't leave," I said, "then I will have to convince them another way. And if they refuse, I'll have to use my gun."
"You mean a gunfight?"
"Yes, that's a very distinct possibility," I said.
"Well, you could be killed."
"Yes, that could happen."
"Well, let's think positive," she said. "When this is all over, we can go for a buggy ride. I know where there's some very pretty country. How's that sound?"
"That sounds good," I said. "Now I think we should go back inside. It's getting late." And we headed back, and Mayor Watkins was waiting. "Go up to bed now, Lacey," he said.
"All right, Papa. Good night."
"Good night, Jed."
"Good night, Lacey," I said.
She went up the stairs. "Please come into the parlor, Jed. We need to talk about what we're going to do tomorrow," said the mayor. "Would you care for something to drink? A whiskey or beer, perhaps?"
"No, sir," I said. "I don't drink hard liquor.
I would like a glass of water." "Be right back," he said, and he left and returned with a large pitcher of water and two glasses. Poured one for me, then one for himself. It was cool to the taste. "How are you going to handle this situation tomorrow?" he asked. "I don't really make plans for this sort of thing," I said. "I just let it play itself out the way it will. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'd kind of like to get some rest." "Of course, I understand," he said. I stood and we shook hands. "Good night, sir," I said.
"Good night, Jed."
Went up to my room and removed my clothes and crawled into bed and fell fast asleep. I awoke the next morning to the sound of roosters crowing. I got out of bed and got ready and went downstairs. I placed my gun on a table by the front door.
"Come right in, Jed. We're about to start without you," said the mayor.
"I'm sorry if I'm late."
"Nonsense, you're our guest. You can sleep as long as you want."
The breakfast of scrambled eggs, fried ham, butter, toast, and fresh squeezed orange juice was very good. When we were finished, Mrs. Watkins said,
"Would you like to come to Christmas dinner, Jed?"
"I'd like that very much, thank you."
"Say around noon, Christmas Day?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Reckon I better go. Thank you again for your hospitality. I enjoyed the meals very much."
Chapter 18. I went to the front door and strapped on my holster. "Want me to go with you?" asked the mayor. "No, it's better if I do this kind of thing alone," I said. "If you went along, I would be worried about you. I couldn't concentrate on the job. Thank you for offering." I walked up Main Street to the saloon, and the noise coming from inside was loud. Stepped up to the boardwalk, went through the door.
"What's wrong, kid? We're closed. Maybe you better turn around and go back down the street to one of the other saloons."
"Don't you think that's a good idea?" And he looked at his partner. The one doing the talking was a burly man wearing black trousers, a black shirt, black boots, and a hat. His face was flushed, probably from drinking too much liquor. He was sporting an ivory-handled pistol low on his right hip, tied down. His partner was thin and wearing regular clothes. He looked like a normal person, not an evil monster.
"Did you hear me, kid? Told you to turn around and look elsewhere for your entertainment."
"I'm here to talk to you, gentlemen," I said.
"Just a kid. What could you possibly have to say that we'd want to hear?"
"I'm going to talk real slow so you'll understand what I'm saying. Turn around and leave before it's too late. As I see it," I said, "you have two options."
"What you mean, two options?"
"Option number one is hand over your guns, march to the jail, and lock yourselves in a cell."
"What's the other option?" he snarled.
"I think you know the other option," I said.
I shot as his gun was clearing his leather, and he fell face down into the sawdust-covered floor. I slid to my right, slouched down, and shot the other fellow in the chest. He fell back against the bar, then slid down until he was sitting on the floor. I replaced the two spent cartridges, slid my gun into my holster, then turned around and walked through the door. There was a lot of excitement on the street. Doors were slamming. Folks were shouting,
"It's over. They're dead. The Avenger of the West did it. He killed them," I heard him say.
They all wanted to shake my hand and pat me on the back. It seemed anything just to touch me. I accepted their goodwill and told them I had to leave.
"Someone needs to call the Undertaker," I said.
"I'm the Undertaker. How long are you going to be in town?"
And he rubbed his hands together. I turned and went to the hotel. There was nobody at the hotel desk, so I reached across and took a key and went up the stairs into a room. It had a bed, chest of drawers, and a washstand. I sat in the bed. It was better than the hard ground, but not by much. There was water in the pitcher, so I poured some in the bowl and washed my face and neck. Then I removed my holster and clothes, stretched out in the bed with my eyes closed, and said a prayer for the two men I had just killed. Then I said a prayer for myself. The next thing I knew, it was morning, and I had slept almost 19 hours. Chapter 19. I went to the livery stable to rent a buggy. The owner's name was Walter Barnes.
"Somebody told me your name was Jenkins. Any kin to Jenkins in Angel Falls, Texas?" he asked me.
"Well, that was my pa," I said. "Yeah, I heard he'd passed. Murdered, if I heard right."
"That's right," I said. "He was a good man. I met him on a trip to Texas a few years back. Real hard worker."
"Thank you for your kind words," I said. "Now what can I do for you?"
"I want to rent a buggy, the courting kind."
"Yeah, and who might you be courting with, if I might ask?"
"Well, Lacey Watkins, if you must know," I said.
"The mayor's daughter?
Well, she's a looker, all right. I'd be careful around her.
I'm just saying. Ain't nothing to me, I reckon. I got just what you need out back.
When you figuring on doing this here courting?"
"Well, the sooner the better, I reckon.
You planning on cleaning up a little bit or not?" he asked.
"Well, I reckon that'd be a good idea. I'll be back round 6:30 or 7 o'clock, I said.
"See you then," said Mr. Barnes.
Chapter 20. I went to Shirley's restaurant looking for the mayor. He was sitting at his table drinking coffee, so I walked over and asked if I could sit down.
"Well, please do," he said. "I understand you have finished what you came here to do."
"Yes, it's done," I said. "There is something I wanted to discuss with you," he said. "I met with the town council, and we want you to be our sheriff."
"Well, I don't believe you really want me for a sheriff," I said.
"One thing, I'm too young. People want an older man with experience.
Also, I'm planning on leaving Angry Orchard as soon as my friends get here. I don't plan on staying here very long, so I say thank you, but no thank you.
Well, I have to say I'm disappointed, said the mayor, but if that's your decision, I'll respect it.
Thank you for that. Now, there's something I need to ask you, I said. When you sent the telegram, you mentioned some sort of compensation. I was wondering if it's still available.
Oh, yes, of course, he said. What kind of compensation were you expecting?
Well, whatever the council decides will be satisfactory, I said.
Well, I'll meet with the council. We can come up with an amount suitable for this type of situation. You want me to bring it to you?
No, I'm going to get a haircut and a shave and take a bath, I said. Then go to the general store and get some new clothes. I will, however, need some money to do that.
Oh, just tell the store clerk that I said it was all right. The barber, of course.
I will tell them immediately, said the mayor. While I was getting a shave and a haircut, the barber had a young lad filling the tub with hot water all the way to the top. It felt delicious. I could have soaked in it all day, but it was starting to cool off, so I got out, dried off, and put my dirty clothes back on. Then I went to the general store to get a new outfit.
What may I help you with, sir? Said the clerk.
Well, I'm going to need a complete outfit. Maybe a couple, I said. First, though, I need to see if my credit's okay.
Oh, yes, sir, said the clerk. The mayor came by just a little while ago. Said to let you have whatever you want. Now, what would you like to see first?
Well, I'm needing everything from the bottom up, I said. 3 pair of dungarees, 3 shirts, 6 underwear, 6 socks, maybe a new pair of boots.
The pants are right over this way, and shirts are next to them. What colors would you like your shirts to be? Asked the clerk.
1 green, 1 blue, 1 black, I said.
Yes, sir, this way to the boots.
And while I was walking past a display case, I saw something that made me stop in my tracks. There, next to some whatnots and some costume jewelry, was a little Bible. It was just like the one Pastor Colson had. He called it his traveling Bible.
Let me see that little Bible, I said. I want that, even if I don't get anything else.
That's a very nice little book, isn't it? Said the clerk.
This is more than a book. This is the written word of God.
Yes, sir, I completely understand.
Now, would you like to look at some boots? He asked.
No, but I would like to look at a hat.
Yes, sir, this way, said the clerk. I have 3 different styles, 1 black, 1 light gray, and then this one that I just got in last week. It's all leather.
It's a good thing I got a haircut so I could see if it fit all right. I'll take the leather one. I think that'll be everything.
We aim to please, or my name's not Augustus S. Finnegas.
He was wrapping up everything when I said, I do want one other item. Let me have a nickel's worth of that rock candy.
He put the candy in a small bag, and it reminded me of when Pa would give me a penny to go to the general store and get some.
I took the package back to my room, ripped it open, and removed that little Bible. Then I took the piece of candy out of the bag and put it in my mouth.
That sure was good.
Stretched out in the bed and opened the Bible. I read until I started getting drowsy. Then I placed the Bible on the nightstand. Next thing I knew, it was morning, and I remembered I was supposed to pick up the buggy.
Chapter 21. I dressed and went to Shirley's to eat breakfast. When I got there, it was almost empty. There were 2 men sitting at separate tables, and I took the mayor's table, hoping he'd show up. A lady came and asked, what did I want to eat? I told her I wanted a Texas-sized steak with 4 eggs on top and a couple of pieces of toast and a big cup of coffee. She returned shortly with a big platter that had a steak hanging over the side. The eggs were on a second plate, and she set down a big cup with a pot of coffee.
I figured you could pour your own coffee, she said. I was almost finished when the mayor came in. Came straight over, sat down, removed his hat, wiped his head with a white handkerchief. I met with the council, he said, and they made a decision. Here's the reward we settled on. He handed it to me, and I put it in my pocket.
Aren't you going to count it? He asked.
Well, I'm sure whatever the council decided will be satisfactory. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go to the livery stable.
Mr. Barnes was feeding the horses when I walked in.
See, you changed your mind about that courting idea.
Nope, I said. Fell asleep last night, or I'd have been here.
But I'm going to take the buggy now, so I won't forget about it.
If I can't talk you out of this blame fool idea, then good riddance, Mr. Barnes said.
I said, thank you for caring, Mr. Barnes.
I parked the buggy behind the hotel and went to my room. I had another piece of candy, then sat in the bed and read my little Bible. I read until noon and went to Shirley's for dinner. I admit Shirley's had some of the best food I had eaten in a long time. I finished and decided to go back to the livery stable to visit with Mr. Barnes.
"Bringing it back already?" he asked.
"No, just killing time. Thought you might want to jaw a while."
"Well, sure, got nothing better to do," he said. "Come on in and sit. What you got on your mind?"
We talked until supper time.
"You better go," he said, "if you plan on eating before you pick up Lacey."
Chapter 22. I finished supper, then went and got the buggy and drove to the Watkins home. I parked and walked to the door, and I was just fixing to knock when the door opened.
"Hello, Jed. Please come into the parlor," said Mrs. Watkins. "I'll call Lacey."
"Lacey, Jed is here." "While we wait for Lacey, would you care for a glass of cider or lemonade?" she asked.
"Lemonade sounds good," I said, and she left and returned with two glasses and a pitcher of lemonade.
She poured a glass, handed it to me, then poured one for herself.
"Where are you planning on going?" she asked.
"Well, Lacey told me she knows of some very pretty places. I imagine we'll go there," I said.
"Yes, I believe I know the place she's talking about. The young folks here go there all the time. In fact, Mr. Watkins and I went there quite often when we were young. Oh, here's Lacey."
Lacey came in wearing a very pretty dress.
"I need my jacket and shawl, and I believe I'll get a blanket. It'll be good to cover our laps and ankles," she said.
"Have a good time," said Mrs. Watkins. I helped Lacey into the buggy, then went around and got in.
"Which way, Lacey?" I said.
"Oh, just go in any direction out of town."
"Thought you said there was a special place we could go.
In fact, your mother said she and your father used to go there."
"Well, we don't want to go there. There'll be a bunch of people. I know a place where we can be alone."
We drove for about 20 minutes.
"Turn into that grove of trees," she said. "There's a pretty cliff on the other side."
I drove through the trees and saw a cliff that looked dangerous.
"Let's go over to the edge," she said. "The view is much better there."
She spread the blanket on the ground.
"See, this blanket has all kinds of uses," she said, and she patted the spot next to her.
"Sit here, Jed." I squatted down, but didn't sit all the way.
"Oh, come on, Jed, I won't bite. Isn't the view spectacular here?"
And she pulled me all the way down.
"Yes, it's very pretty," I said.
The darkness almost smothered the moon until an orange streak of light on the horizon peeked over the snow-covered tops of the mountains where they seemed to touch the sky. She reached up and touched my cheek and said, "You shaved just for me, didn't you?"
"Well, I needed to shave anyway," I said.
"You remember when we talked about you having a girlfriend sitting out in the garden?"
"Yes, I remember."
"Well, you had that gunfight and you're all right. Don't you think that could be a sign that we're a nice couple?"
"Well, it could be," I said. "But I told you that I could never have a girlfriend. Do you remember that?"
"Well, maybe you don't want a girlfriend, but maybe you need a wife."
"If I can't have a girlfriend, how could I have a wife?" I said.
"Well, let me show you how much fun it would be to have a wife."
And she reached over and pulled me against her body. Then she pressed her lips against mine. Now, I've only kissed two girls in my entire life, but those two kisses were nothing like the kiss Lacey gave me. Her lips melted into mine, sending waves of heat down my body. Her lips were gentle, sweet, and warm. I didn't want this feeling to end, but the kiss stopped too soon.
"Did you like that, Jed? There's more.
Much more." She laid back on the blanket and pulled me down on top of her, and her lips met mine again and again. I was having a hard time breathing, so I sat up straight. Her nearness made my heart beat faster. I breathed in her essence, and when she kissed me, it made me have feelings that I didn't want to have, didn't have the right to feel. I made a vow to God when I accepted Christ that I would remain chaste. If I continued with Lacey the way I was going, I was afraid that vow might be broken. I pushed her back away slowly and said,
"I think we'd better go back."
"Aren't you enjoying it?" she said. "Is it my freckles? You don't like my freckles, do you?"
"Well, I think your freckles are beautiful, and yes, I am enjoying myself, but perhaps too much."
"It can be much, much better," she said. "Just relax and enjoy."
"I've already told you."
I don't need or want a girlfriend or wife, and that's final, I said.
All the girls my age are already married, and most of them are expecting a baby. I'll be 18 in a couple of months. I'm going to be an old maid, I just know it.
I'm sorry, I said, but I'm not getting married. We need to head back now.
If you insist, you don't know what you're missing. When we arrived back at the Watkins home, Lacey jumped out and ran to the door without saying anything. I thought to myself, did I just escape from a very sticky situation or not? I left the buggy back at the livery stable and went to my room for the rest of the night. For the next few days, I visited with Mr. Barnes at the livery stable. I told him about my courting and how it had ended, and he told me we were well enough acquainted so I could call him Walter. "I think you're right about escaping a bad situation," he said. "Think you want to see her again?" "Well, I do have to go to her house for Christmas dinner," I said. "How you reckon that'll go?" "Well, I don't really know, but I guess I'll find out. Don't want to miss out on a good dinner," I said.
Chapter 23. The next day was Christmas. I dressed in my new clothes that I hadn't worn yet and walked to the Watkins home. I knocked and Mrs. Watkins opened the door. Then she stepped back and said, "Please come in. Dinner will be ready shortly. The mayor's in the living room, so please go on in."
"Hello, Jed. Glad you could make it," he said. "Lacey was telling me that you might be tied up with another engagement. Did you enjoy your buggy ride with her? I couldn't get her to comment one way or another. Hope everything's all right with you two. You do make a lovely couple. Perhaps I should talk to her and try to explain how it is with you." "Well, I do think we should have an understanding about our relationship," I said. "Not available for marrying anyone, and that includes your daughter. I'm sorry if you or she misunderstood my intentions. I will be moving on as soon as my friends arrive. Now, if I'm still welcome for dinner, I would enjoy the company of your family, and that includes Lacey."
"Oh, I keep telling Lacey that she shouldn't be in such a hurry to get married," the mayor said. "The right young man will come along. They'll get married, have a dozen babies, and be together forever. She considers herself an old maid. She's not even 18 yet. Don't understand women, even though I've been married to one all these years. Let me see if dinner's about ready. Make yourself comfortable."
"Please come into the dining room, Jed. Sit here next to Lacey," the mayor said.
"Thank you, sir. Everything looks delicious, ma'am.
Roasted turkey with dressing and gravy, boiled potatoes, green beans, bread and butter, and iced tea. Then there was apple pie for dessert. The mayor asked me if I would ask God to bless the food and fellowship, and I obliged. While we were eating, Lacey and her mother were acting as cold as the snow-covered mountains. However, the mayor kept up a lively conversation, and when we were finished, the mayor asked if I would like to retire to the parlor with him for a visit. I declined, stating, "Oh, I have to get back, sir. Don't want to be out too late in this weather." "As far as I'm concerned, you're welcome any time," the mayor said.
"Well, thank you, sir," I said. "I appreciate that. Let me tell the ladies good night, and I'll go."
I went into the kitchen where Lacey and her mother were cleaning up, and I said, "I wanted to tell you, as always, the meal was superb. Thank you for inviting me. It meant a lot to me to have some place to go for Christmas dinner. Thank you again."
Mrs. Watkins seemed to melt a bit and said, "Merry Christmas, Jed, and good night."
Lacey looked my way, and I guess it wasn't very nice, but I winked at her.
"See you around, Lacey," I said. "Good night, Merry Christmas."
She blushed and ran out of the kitchen.
"Good night again, Mrs. Watkins," I said.
As he walked me to the door, Mayor Watkins said,
"Night, Jed."
"Good night, sir." Chapter 24. It rained for 2 days straight. Mud was everywhere, in the cafe, the general store, and even the livery stable, though you couldn't really tell the difference there. The temperature dropped, and it snowed 6 inches overnight. It was extremely difficult getting around, but it wasn't long before the foot and animal traffic cleared away enough of the road for us to move around. I'd been visiting with Walter at the livery stable. Felt good helping with the animals, and Walter wanted me to come to work for him. Had to admit I was enjoying it a lot. Walter was knowledgeable about everything, not just livery stable stuff, but life in general. He also taught me a new game called pool. It had all these little balls on it on a green table, and you used a stick to get the balls in, what he called pockets. It was a really fun game, but I wasn't very good at it. Walter told me I just needed more practice to be as good as him, maybe even better. We talked about everything. He was very persistent about me coming to work for him.
I told him I really enjoy the company of the animals, and of course your company too. But as soon as my friends show up, we'll probably be leaving Angry Orchard. By the way, do you know why this town is named Angry Orchard? Well, it seems when the first settlers arrived, there was a large orchard of different kinds of fruit trees, he said. It was almost as if someone had planted it that way. It wasn't only filled with fruit, but also had thousands of hornets and wasp nests. It took them almost a year to get rid of those pests. Therefore, they called the settlement Angry Orchard. That's the way I heard it, anyway.
Chapter 25. The next few days I strolled around town, looking in all the businesses. Angry Orchard was quite a bit bigger than Angel Falls. Got to know a lot of the business owners by name, and almost every one of them asked if I was going to take the sheriff's job. But I politely informed them I would not. I spent the majority of my time at the livery stable. The more time I spent there, the more time I missed Sugar, and of course, I also missed Orville and Half Loaf. It had been almost a month since I left Velvet Sky, and they could arrive any time now. Walter asked if my pa was still running the blacksmith shop when he was killed. I said, yes, he was the best smithy in 5 counties. He told me once that the blacksmith was the heart and soul of a community. Now everything can be ordered through Montgomery Ward catalog, so it seemed that the blacksmith was no longer needed. In most towns, the blacksmith shop was nothing more than a fix-it shop. Pa did a lot of repairing, but very little building. Walter said, well, we got a smithy that could be almost as good as your pa. He works for Matthew Stackman, who owns the shop. Well, I haven't seen a blacksmith shop while I've been walking around town, I said. Where is it located? It's kind of out of the way down on Cyclone Street, Walter said. It's named that because a tornado hit a few years back and wiped out all the buildings on that street. Mr. Stackman says location don't mean much if you got a good-looking place. And he does have one of the best-looking places in town, painted up real nice and looks like a new building. Ralph Snowden is the name of the smithy. Ain't nobody better for miles and miles. I said, well, maybe I'll mosey over and get acquainted with Ralph Snowden. How do you get to Cyclone Street? Well, you go down Main Street, turn left on Hickory, then go 2 blocks to Forest Street, and it'll be the shiniest building there, said Walter. Sticks out like a new diamond. Okay, reckon I'll see you later. I followed the directions just like he said. Wasn't a problem finding the place, and Walter was right about it looking like a new building. Looked like it was painted just yesterday. I went inside, looked all around for the smithy, but only one person in sight, and he didn't look like any smithy I ever saw. There was a tall, thin man in his early 60s in the back of the shop. He was wearing black trousers, a white shirt, and a vest under a dark blue coat. He was wearing a derby hat with high-top button-down shoes. He turned around and saw me and said, "Hello, young man. You were probably expecting someone a little different. I'm the owner of this establishment. The man that works for me is out today. Wife's having a baby. He'll be here as soon as it's born," he said. "I don't understand why he had to take off. He's not the one having the baby. Some men take it as serious as the woman," he said. "But do not worry. I do know a thing or two about working a blacksmith shop. I wasn't always as successful. Don't let the clothes fool you. I assure you I can handle any job you want done. Now what can I help you with?" "Well, I was wanting to meet Mr. Snowden," I said. "As I said, Ralph will be here when he gets here. Can't hurry women about this kind of thing, if you know what I mean. Is there something I can help you with? Or is it only Ralph that can help you?" "Oh, no, sir, I don't want any work done. Just wanted to visit with him, talk about smithy stuff. My pa was a smithy in Angel Falls, Texas, until he was murdered. I thought maybe Mr. Snowden might have known him." "Well, like I told you, he'll be back whenever," the man said. "Thank you kindly," I said. "Reckon I'll get back to town. Goodbye, sir." "Goodbye, young man." "Oh, sorry I didn't introduce myself," I said. "My name's Jed Jenkins." "I likewise didn't introduce myself. I'm Matthew Stackman. I own this blacksmith shop and several other businesses around town. I have been very lucky indeed." "Did you say Jenkins in Angel Falls, Texas?" "Yes, sir, that's correct," I said. "I knew a Jeremiah Jenkins. Was he your father?" "Yes, sir, he was my pa." "I'm sorry to hear that. The Jenkins I knew was an honest, upstanding man who worked hard and treated everyone with respect." "Yes, sir," I said, "that's the way he was." "Yeah, my sympathy, Jed." "Thank you very much for those kind words. I'll tell Ralph you came by. Thank you again. See you around."
went back to the livery stable, and Walter and me went to Shirley's to eat dinner. I told him Mr. Snowden wasn't there and that his wife was having a baby, but that I did meet Mr. Stackman. Chapter 26. I was walking down one of the side streets when I heard a big commotion in one of the alleys. I walked over, and there in the corner where he couldn't escape was a dog being beaten by a man.
"Hey, hold on there," I said. "What you doing to that dog? Are you blind? Do you need glasses?" He turned and looked at me. "What you mean, what am I doing?"
"How would you like it if someone beat on you like that?" I said.
"Hey, it's just a dumb dog. Besides that, he's been stealing eggs from my hen house."
"Well, maybe he's hungry. Do you ever consider that?"
"You know, when an animal gets hungry, he'll do things he wouldn't normally do, just like people."
"Tell you what, how much you figure those eggs are worth?" I said.
"Why, you gonna pay for 'em? Why would you do that? He's just a stray."
"Let's just say I've been hungry a time or two. Now, how much?"
"I guess 25 cents should cover it."
"I figure the price of eggs is closer to 15 cents, but I'll make an exception because I'm feeling generous. However, there is one stipulation that I require of you," I said.
"Stip you what? What's that?" he said.
"It means that if you take the 25 cents, you have to do something in return."
"What'd you want I should do?" he asked.
"Don't ever hit another animal. Just remember, you might be hungry someday."
"Sure, I can do that. Won't never hit another animal, I promise."
"Here's the money. Now don't forget."
"I won't." And he took the money.
I looked at the dog cowering in the corner. He hadn't moved, he was so scared. He looked to be part wolf.
"Come on, boy. Nobody's going to hurt you," I spoke in a very quiet voice.
He sneaked over to my outstretched hand and licked it.
"That's a good boy. Are you hungry?"
I patted him between the eyes, and his tail started wagging.
"Well, come on, boy. Let's get you something to eat."
And we walked over to Shirley's.
"We don't allow dogs inside," said the woman.
"How about if he waits outside?" I asked. "Can you fix him a meal?"
"Oh, sure, I can fix him something, I guess."
She came back with a big plate of something that looked like leftovers.
"Are those table scraps?"
"Yeah, what'd you expect? It's just a dog. I'm not going to charge you for it."
"Okay, well, thanks a lot. Could you have something fixed every day about this time?"
"Sure, I reckon I can do that. You going to bring him around?"
"Well, I guess I will until I can find him a good home."
"I don't think you'll find a home for him. He's got quite a reputation around town. He's a thief."
"Has anyone asked the question, why?" I said. "Did anyone ever consider that he might just be hungry?"
"I don't reckon nobody ever did that," she said. "Here's his meal," and she handed the plate to me, and I took it outside.
"Okay, boy, here's something to eat. Now take it slow so you don't get sick." And he started gobbling it down.
"Slow down, boy."
I reached down and picked up the plate. He looked up at me as if to say, "What are you doing?" I put it back down, and he continued eating and wagging his tail.
"I have to think of a name for you, won't we, boy?"
I'd always wanted a dog when I was younger, but Pa said we didn't have enough time to take care of one. Now I was older,
and I still didn't have the time
or a way to take care of a dog. Maybe if I can't find a good home for him here in Angry Orchard, Orville will take care of him and let him ride in his wagon. Now that sounds like a plan I could live with. I looked all over town for someone to take the dog and give him a good home, but like Shirley had said, he had a bad reputation and no one wanted him. I persuaded the desk clerk at the hotel into letting him sleep in my room with me. I think it was because I worded it in a special way that he let him stay. I decided that if he was going to be my dog, he needed a real special name. So I sat on the bench in front of the hotel trying to decide on a name for the dog sitting in front of me. "Looks kind of like a wolf," I thought.
"How about Wolf?" I said.
He looked up at me, then licked my hand as if to say, "That sounds like a good name. Orville and Halfloaf should be here in a couple of days. I sure have missed them and my horse Sugar." The snow had just about all melted, but the mud was still here, and I kept trying to remember if the weather in Texas was like this. I was amazed at how short our memories are when we're trying to remember something. Of course, there are more important things to remember than the weather, like remembering my Pa and my friends back there in Angel Falls, and the new folks that I have met along this journey. Wolf and me have been going every day to Shirley's to eat for almost a month. She'd been feeding him very well, and you can tell the difference. He's filled out, and I reckon he might weigh close to 50 pounds.
I sure wouldn't want to make him mad at me. 2 days later, Wolf and me were waiting on a bench in front of the stage depot. We'd been doing this fairly regular for 3 or 4 days.
Chapter 27. It looked like this was our lucky day. There, coming around the corner, was what looked like a small covered wagon. Then I remembered when Mr. Grigsby gave us the canvas and stuff to change his buckboard into a covered wagon, and I was glad to see them. I jumped down off the boardwalk, and just about then Sugar saw me and started prancing and whinnying. I had stopped at Mr. Fingus's general store and bought some sugar cubes. Sugar loved sugar cubes a lot. I raced across the street and grabbed Sugar's bridle. She kept trying to nudge my face, and I scratched her between the eyes. I swear I could hear her purring like a cat. "Am I glad to see you, Sugar?" I said. "How about us?" shouted Orville. "Of course, I'm glad to see all of you," I said. "I just figured you'd understand better than a horse." Orville jumped down and grabbed me around the neck. "Missed you a lot. Half-loaf's good company, but he sings too much, and he won't stop. Just sings and sings and sings. He won't even stop if I ask him nice," Orville said. "Hello, Jed. It's good to see you again." "I did indeed miss you very much," said Half-Loaf. "I really missed you fellas," I said. "Did you get the job done you came to do? And did they ask you to be sheriff?" "Yes, to both," I said. "And your answer to being sheriff?" Well, my answer was no. However, they didn't want me for sheriff. They wanted me to be their peacekeeper. "Just a fancy name for sheriff, if I know my English," said Half-Loaf. "That's what I said to him. Let's take this old piece of junk over to the livery stable. I'll introduce you to Walter Barnes. He's the owner and a real good friend. Then we'll get something to eat. Unless you want to fix something. I've missed your meals."
"Well, I believe Half-Loaf would disagree with you about my cooking," said Orville.
"As for me, whatever you decide will suit just fine. Say, what's this mutt hanging around you for?"
"Well, that isn't a mutt," I said. "That's Wolf. He's our dog."
"Hold on. What do you mean, our dog?"
"What is our job in the world?" I said. "Is it not helping those in need? Well, Wolf was in need of some help, and I helped him. Can't find anyone that wants to give him a permanent home, so I decided if you'd allow him to join you in your wagon, he'd be our dog. How about it?"
"Well, I reckon if he is in need of help, then we should help him. Welcome, Wolf," Orville said, and he reached down and petted him on the head.
Wolf seemed happy enough with Orville. "But how about Half-Loaf? Would he like him?"
"About it, Half-Loaf. You want a dog?"
"I really don't like dogs. I was bitten one time, and I've been afraid ever since."
"Well, I don't think Wolf will bite you," I said, "especially if you're nice and give him a treat once in a while."
"Okay, I will try. But if he bites me, I will be very upset."
"It's a deal. You won't bite him, will you, Wolf?"
Wolf started wagging his tail and licked Half-Loaf's hand.
"He tried to bite me," shouted Half-Loaf.
"I think he was just tasting you," said Orville.
"Stop that, Orville. This is serious. Wolf was licking your hand to tell you he likes you," I said.
"All right," said Half-Loaf hesitantly.
"Shirley's restaurant has some of the best meatloaf I've ever had," I said. "You want to go there?"
"Sounds good to me," said Orville. "How about you, Half-Loaf?"
"Sure, that is fine with me. How about Wolf?"
"Oh, Wolf eats there, too," I said.
Wolf sat on the boardwalk to the side of the entrance, waiting patiently, and we took a table to the left of the door.
"Hello, Jed. Looks like your friends finally made it. What can I get for you fellas?" said Shirley.
"Jed was telling us that your meatloaf's mighty tasty. Reckon that's what we'll have with a big glass of iced tea."
"Do have ice, don't you?" asked Orville.
"Look at the mountains." "We got plenty of ice," she said. She returned shortly with 3 big platters of meatloaf, little green peas, mashed potatoes, bread and butter, and 3 tall glasses of iced tea. Half-Loaf took a bite of the meatloaf.
"It has to be good to have the same name as me," he said.
"And it is good, very good."
"I second that," said Orville. "Are we going to save some of this for Wolf?"
"No," I said. "Wolf is already eaten today. He only eats once a day, so he fills up when he can. He was without anything to eat for so long that he never knows if he's going to get to eat anything more."
"Well, if he's going to partner with us, he won't get plenty to eat," said Orville.
"None of our crew will go hungry, not as long as I'm the cook."
While we were eating, I asked about the trip.
"Yeah, without you along," said Orville's, "like any other trip, long and boring."
I said, "Well, come on, I'll show you around this great metropolis."
We told Shirley how much we enjoyed the meal. Orville said, "You know, if I was the marrying kind, I'd marry you, Miss Shirley." "I don't think my husband would like that very much," she said, "but I am flattered that you would think of me that way. Is it me or the food that has you interested?"
"Maybe a little of both," said Orville. "I reckon we'll see you next time." "Come on, Wolf," I said, and he followed behind us as we walked down the street, taking in the sights.
Chapter 28.
"You know, I ain't had nothing to drink since the whiskey I had at the Marietta Horse Ranch," said Orville. "Think I may go to the saloon and wet my whistle. Want to come along, half loaf?"
"No, thank you. I am like Jed. I do not like the taste of liquor."
"Suit yourself. See you later." "Wished he wouldn't do that, but he's a grown man, and I can't tell him what to do," I said. "Let's go and sit at the gazebo over behind the old courthouse." It was all that was left when the courthouse burned down a few years back. We were sitting, watching the sun as it descended behind the mountains. The horizon changed so many brilliant colors, and it was a beautiful sight, almost like watching a rainbow, but much more colorful. Half Loaf and Wolf were getting along fine. Half Loaf had warmed up to him just a little, and he even gave him a piece of the meatloaf from supper. Wolf was sitting close, hoping for some more to eat, when all of a sudden there was a loud noise. If I'm correct, that sounded like gunshots, and they were coming from the saloon. "Orville's over there, and he doesn't have his gun. Let's go," I said. There was a big crowd of people in the street in front of the saloon, and Orville was in the middle of it with his hands in the air. One of the men had his gun pointed right at him. "Dunn told you I didn't mean to bump you and make you spill your drink. Even offered to buy you another one," Orville said.
"Man can't even drink without bumping into you. Need to make special places for old guys like you," said the man with the gun.
I walked up between the man with the gun and Orville, and I said, "Maybe you don't want to deal with an old man, but how about me? Would you like that?" I motioned for Orville to leave. "How about it? You want to tell me how I should have a place just like that old man?"
"I know who you are. You're that Avenger guy. The Avenging Angel of the West. That's who you are. They say you're faster than greased lightning," said the man.
"I don't know about the angel stuff, but I can say that I'm pretty fast. Greased lightning? I don't know. I do know how you can find out, though. Do you really want to know?"
"No, thank you. I don't want no trouble with you."
"Then let me tell you something," I said, "and this is for all you people. That old man and this young man are friends of mine, and I sure would hate to hear about anyone letting anything happen to either one of them. And by the way, just so you know, this dog is my friend also. Everyone hear what I'm saying?" Everyone shook their heads as they walked away or back to the saloon. I went back over to the gazebo and sat there with Orville, Half Loaf, and Wolf, my three friends.
"Won't tell you something, Jed. I don't think I'll ever go into another saloon again," Orville said. "Maybe that feller was right. I do belong in an old folks' home. I slipped on the sawdust and bumped into him by accident, and he got mad. If I'd have went with you, wouldn't have happened. Maybe there is something to not drinking, at least not in a saloon. Thank you for bailing me out."
"Nothing I wouldn't do for anybody else in the same situation," I said.
"When I thought I was special," said Orville.
"Well, let's head for the hotel. I got rooms for us."
Chapter 29. The next morning at breakfast, I suggested something to them. "I think I know something we can do to keep us out of trouble. Let's go hunting for antelope. Folks say they are plentiful here in the mountains on the east slope. How does that sound? We can take food in the tent. We still have a tent, don't we?"
"Sounds good to me," said Orville.
"I haven't had antelope since we had that stew at Trader Tom's. I'll even bet Wolf would like to go hunting. How about it, Wolf? Want to go hunting?"
Wolf got so excited running around, barking and jumping. Orville suggested that we take the wagon as far as we could, then walk the rest of the way.
"That's a good idea," I said. "We can carry back the game in it."
"We'll need to build a sled to carry the carcass back to the wagon," said Half Loaf.
"Sounds like this is going to turn into a big job, and we ain't even got started," said Orville.
"Aw, come on, it'll be fun. Just think of fresh antelope steaks," I said.
"I know just how to fix 'em so they'll melt in your mouth," said Orville. "First you cut the loin in half-inch steaks, then rub the steaks with olive oil and sprinkle each side with salt and black pepper. The oil prevents the meat from drying out while cooking.
build a grill across some rocks about 6 inches above the flames and turn them after about 5 to 6 minutes, or when you feel they're ready. Use tongs to turn them and avoid turning them more than once, Orville said.
Sure sounds delicious, I said. Let's go get us some antelope.
We ain't got but one carbine, said Orville. We should go buy one for each of you.
Chapter 30. We went to Mr. Finnegas' store and got 2 rifles. After introducing them, we told Mr. Finnegas what we wanted and what we were going to do.
Oh, my. You did say you were from Texas, didn't you? He asked.
Yes, we're from Texas. Why'd you ask? I answered.
I know it snows in Texas.
But does it snow this much? Asked Mr. Finnegas.
No, I don't suppose it snows quite this much, I answered.
Well, I wouldn't advise going up in those mountains in the middle of January. There might come a blizzard, and you could get stuck up there.
We wouldn't want that, now would we? Said Finnegas.
No, but we wanted to go hunting for antelope, said Orville.
I would recommend that you wait till March or April, or you could hunt lower down, just don't go up high.
Stay at the bottom in the forest. You can find plenty of game there, said Finnegas.
Well, I reckon that's what we'll have to do. We'll still need 2 rifles with ammunition and whatever you'd recommend to have a safe hunting expedition.
Absolutely, he said. I can do that, or my name isn't Augustus S. Finnegas. We loaded all the supplies into the wagon, then went up the street to Shirley's to eat.
Wolf was very excited. He knew something different was about to happen.
After we finished eating, we headed for the foothills east of town. We set up the tent, gathered wood, built a fire. I hadn't noticed the cold so much before Mr. Finnegas said all that stuff about blizzards.
Orville said, I remember one time when we was traveling in Virginia. Got so cold the water in my canteen froze solid.
It's not another one of your tall tales, is it? Asked Half Loaf.
Nope, it's God's honest truth, so help me. Well, no matter how cold it gets, we still got to eat, he said.
First thing in the morning, we'll go up to the left of that tree line, I said.
It was cold, but that didn't take away from anything from the beautiful sight of nature at work. The green of the trees, the grass, and the bushes mixed together with the snow. It was indeed something to behold, the handiwork of God.
What you looking at, Jed? Asked Orville.
Just looking. I don't think we do that often enough. Just stop what we're doing and look.
Look, there are 2 rabbits over there, said Half Loaf.
Stay, Wolf, I commanded. Now it's time to see if you've learned how to shoot straight.
He took out his pistol, aimed, and shot straight and true. As he was aiming at the rabbit, I took out my gun, and we both shot at the same time.
Looks like I learned real good, said Half Loaf. 2 rabbits with 1 shot.
You ignoramus, said Orville. Jed shot one of them. Glad I didn't start cooking yet. Now we can have a rabbit.
How's that sound, Wolf?
Go get him, Wolf, I told him. He took off and brought one back, dropped it at my feet, and went for the other.
Hey, I'm the one got to cook 'em, said Orville. You should have brought 'em to me.
I have to admit that Orville knows how to cook. He cleaned those 2 varmints, and then we roasted them over the fire in no time at all.
Maybe I will shoot some more rabbits tomorrow. These are very tasty, said Half Loaf.
They don't taste good because you shot 'em. They taste good because I cooked 'em, Orville fussed.
Ah, yes, but if I had not shot them, we would not be able to taste them at all, argued Half Loaf.
Let's just enjoy and not fuss, I said. And I gave a piece to Wolf, and he gobbled it down. I reckon he enjoyed those rabbits as much as we did.
It was getting late. The temperature was dropping fast.
Looks like it might come a snowstorm.
Sure would hate to be out here if comes a bad one, I said.
Let's wait a little while, said Orville.
If the temperature keeps dropping, I'd suggest we go back to town.
But I only got to shoot 1 rabbit, Half Loaf whined.
Well, if we freeze to death, you won't be shooting anything, said Orville.
All right, but it wasn't much of a trip, said Half Loaf.
That's the way of life sometimes. You just suck it up and move on.
Orville spoke as he would to a child.
A little over an hour passed, and it started snowing lightly.
I recommend we pack up our gear and head back to town before it gets so thick we can't see, I told him.
We broke the tent down, packed it in the wagon, then climbed aboard, went back down the mountain.
Well, we can try another time, I reckon. Rabbits were good, but we didn't have to do any traveling to eat rabbit.
There's a lot of them on the outskirts of town, said Orville.
You're right about that. However, we did get to spend some quality time together, I said.
We got into town close to midnight and went straight to the hotel.
It was nice getting out of the weather.
The next morning, there was a knock at my door. "Just a minute," I said, and I got out of bed and opened the door.
"Sorry to disturb you, but I just received this telegram for you. It says urgent, so I brought it right over,"
the telegraph operator said as he stood in the doorway.
"Well, thank you," I said. "In just a minute, I'll get you a tip." "No tip necessary, sir. Part of the job."
I opened the telegram and it read, "Jed, I hope this wire reaches you before you leave Angry Orchard. I also hope you remember me. I'm the doctor who was on the stage with you, Dr. Ferguson. I told you I was going to Clearstone, Wyoming. Well, if you're available, we could use your help. There are some men on the way to Clearstone to do bodily harm to some of our leading citizens. They're not here yet, but are expected at any time. If you can, please come. Signed, Dr. Ferguson."
"Looks like we're going on a trip, Wolf. Think you'll like that," I said.
He answered by giving a little woof, then licked my hand.
"Let's go wake the fellas and explain to them what's happening, so we can see what we're going to do about this situation."
Orville said,
"Well, we're still packed from our great hunting experience, so we're ready whenever you are."
"Well, how about we eat breakfast and consider our options," I said. And while we were eating, we talked it over. "I figure if we can average around 20 miles a day and possibly a little more, with longer days, we can get there in a little over a week," I explained.
"Like I said early this morning," said Orville, "we're all packed and ready to roll whenever you are.
Well, let me send a telegram to Dr. Ferguson, let him know we're on our way, and approximately when we'll arrive.
And then let's saddle up and go to Clearstone, Wyoming," said Half Loaf.
This has been Angry Orchard, Colorado, written by J.C. Halsey, narrated by Chaz Allen. Copyright March 3rd, 2015 by J.C. Halsey. Production copyright 2015 by Outlaw Publishing.